Morning InfoWars, your source for uncensored truth this morning is Brianna Morello.
Good morning, my beautiful truth seekers. It is a great, great day. A lot going on in the world today. We're very excited that you are joining us. Man, we've got a jam-packed program heading your way this weekend. A lot to unpack. So let's just highlight some of the things that happened late yesterday evening, because the Friday headlines, they always try to sneak things in there that they don't want you to see because they hope you're not paying attention. But you know, we love to expose just that. Take a look at the first story with an Obama-appointed judge, Edward Chen, saying that the Trump administration can't terminate the temporary protected status of over 1.1 million illegal Venezuelans and Haitians living in the United States. Now, as many of you guys know at home, the Biden regime allowed these illegal aliens into our country. They shipped them in, and now Trump wants them out. And so, of course, what are the courts trying to do? Well, they're trying to block it. And you can strongly rely on both the Biden and Obama regime to be the ones standing in the way of that, of course. But as you know, the DOJ will challenge it and we'll keep the fight going. Let's turn to something else I thought was very, very interesting. Kamala Harris, remember her? She is the failed presidential campaign that launched against President Trump. Well, I mean, she's kind of bored these days, not really making much in the way of money, given the fact that she doesn't really have much to sell. But folks, I saw something that was very, very interesting. It's a new report saying that she was paid $500,000 to bash Elon Musk. Now, it gets even worse because she spent, with her Secret Service detail, so that means your money, $81,000 on security. That's according to the Center to Advance Security. Now, folks, she literally was paid $500,000. I don't know why anyone would pay that. But on our expense, now we have to cough up the $81,000 that it costs to bring her to Hawaii to speak at this event. It's absolutely egregious. But thankfully, President Trump has shut that down, removing her Secret Service detail because, obviously, folks, that is abuse. Let's turn to something else that we could all celebrate. President Trump signed his 200th executive order yesterday. And this one was a big one. He's renaming the Department of Defense the Department of War. Now, it does need congressional approval still, but we're still changing nameplates. And I think that's so important. Even the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, was very excited about that. He, in front of his office, decided to switch over his plates as well. And now we all have to get used to this new title. I'll probably slip up a couple of times, but it's no longer the Department of Defense. They are the Department of War. And I'd love to see it, because through peace, if you want peace, you have to be prepared to fight in war. And that is exactly what the great folks over at the Department of Defense formally want you to know. I'm very excited about this. This is going to be a great one. Pete Hegseth really turning things around for our country, and we are thankful for just that. All right, we got a jam-packed program heading your way in just a few moments. You may have seen it. It's good news, but it's a drop in the bucket. The Trump administration says that they have found over 22,000 unaccompanied migrant children that the Biden regime shipped all across our country through human traffickers. Now, 22,000, again, drop in the bucket considering the fact that there's over 300,000 that are still missing. We're going to dive through the numbers in just a few moments with a whistleblower who's saying that although this is great news, we could be doing significantly more. And also, I mean, you may have seen it, but President Trump, and this one had me on edge a little bit, President Trump had Bill Gates at the White House this week, and then they destroyed, or they tried to destroy RFK Jr. over on the Hill by bashing him. I'm talking about like Elizabeth Warren and all of your regular pharmaceutical hacks, the ones who are being sponsored by the regimes. It was absolutely egregious. Tom Renz joining us to kind of walk through all of that, because we're also going to be debating the vaccine angle in all of this, given the fact that now Florida is looking to no longer require mandates when it comes to vaccines. President Trump actually speaking out against that. It's a very, very interesting take. We're going to dive into that in a few moments. Plus, Alex Rosen has been in the state of Florida, and he's leaving his impact by catching a bunch of predators. And there's one interesting one, and I just recently reached out to their employer for comment. So a lot going on this beautiful morning. Don't go anywhere. We've got a lot to get into. I, for one, have a lot that I have to say, so don't go anywhere.
How do I explain to people that my tongue is blue? Because I love this stuff, methylene blue. I'm able to work like 18-hour days sometimes. This stuff is like rocket fuel.
I didn't know you were going to plug this. You even ordered it yourself, I later learned. What is the effect of our medical-grade methylene blue been on you, Roger?
Incredible, both physical and mental energy and focus. I mean, it really is like rocket fuel. Oh, you still like Brain Force? Back when I did the show with Owen Schroyer, the original, the real War Room, I was a big aficionado of Brain Force and Brain Force Force Plus. This is even a greater product. I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Well, I've not had any since Friday. I only take it every couple of days. So I'm going to take my dose of methylene blue at my Topo Chico. It is amazing. And people ask me, what does it do? It cleans out your mitochondria. It skips the oxidization process in the cell. It's like iodine to the next level. It is such a game changer. Roger Stone, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. God bless you.
Other networks lie to you about what's happening now. Brianna Morello tells you the truth about what's happening next on Good Morning InfoWars.
All right, there's some good news. The Trump administration is trying to locate the thousands of children that went missing under the Biden regime. Now, Fox News got an exclusive in regards to what the new administration is doing to find those children. Take a listen.
More than 22,000 unaccompanied children have been found so far under this Trump administration. 27 of the minors were found dead, either murdered or by suicide, car accident, or drug overdoses. And more than 400 sponsors have been arrested.
We're talking about debt bondage, where children are being made to work off debt, trafficking debt. We're talking about children that were brought into situations and then treated like sexual slaves.
In early 2021, record number of children became crossing the border. According to HHS, between 2021 to 2024, more than 470,000 unaccompanied children crossed into the United States. Records show that many of these children were released to sponsors under very laxed vetting policies.
The Biden regime ran one of the biggest human trafficking smuggling rings in this world's history. I mean, there's no other way to argue that, folks. It is absolutely egregious what happened under their watch. And the whistleblowers that came forward were widely ignored. But these were the photos that we were seeing while this was all going on. And so many lawmakers just decided to look the other way. Take a look at this image of an unaccompanied child who made their way into the United States back in 2023. We have this because of Allie Bradley, who found this child and shared this photo. The child has a photo of whoever their sponsor is supposed to be or whoever their point of contact is supposed to be on their shirt. And that's what they saw when they arrived. Now, as many of you guys know, this has been an issue that's been close to my heart, and I have been trying my very best to blow the whistle on a lot of this by speaking to whistleblowers and trying to amplify their message. Just a couple of months ago, I released this exclusive on the independentnewsroom.com, and it says specifically that HSI can't find 95% of the 100,000 unaccompanied migrant children that they were looking for. They couldn't find them because under the Biden regime, they were handed false addresses and poorly vetted sponsors were given these children. Folks, it's absolutely egregious. And now the Trump administration has their work cut out. So yes, it is great that we've located at least 22,000 of these children, but there's over 300,000 of them still missing. Joining me to discuss a woman who has been trying to blow the whistle on all of this for quite some time. Please welcome Tara Rodas to the show. She's a federal whistleblower exposing government-sponsored, taxpayer-funded child trafficking within HHS. Tara, I got to say, this is good to hear. So we'll start off with a positive note on this beautiful morning because they're trying. That's more than what the Biden regime was doing. They're trying to find these children. So far, they found 22,000. I'm a little disappointed in the numbers of these sponsors that have been arrested thus far, though. But what is your overall reaction to the latest count?
So it's a great start. And it's a great start that they have put some new rules in place. I got to meet with Acting Director Salazar and Fabricatori, who was just on, who you just showed that clip of. They have new policies. They have DNA testing. Imagine that, to make sure that the child is really related to the sponsor. They are requiring official identification, not just some international driver's license that you can purchase off of the internet. Fingerprinting. They are fingerprinting all adults in the household. They want verification of income. They want to, you know, the sponsor to be able to prove that they can actually care for the child. So these are all great things moving forward. Another key thing, if an organization has been found to be sexually abusing the children, like Southwest Key, they are no longer getting children to care for. So all these things are great moving forward to prevent children going into harm's way. The challenge, of course, is to now clean up the disaster that the Biden open border policies unleashed on these children. This is a crisis, a humanitarian crisis. There are still over 300,000 children missing, and only 422 sponsors have been arrested and are being prosecuted. So we need to up those numbers of those sponsors. I know that you have talked with DHS whistleblower Aaron Stevenson. He's the very first person who was alerted and tried to alert everyone to this problem. He was telling everyone at DHS because in March of 2021, he saw transnational criminal gangs getting the children. He was the first to identify, and he alerted us. So at this very moment, 4 years ago, I was sitting on the Pomona Fairplex. I had already seen his disclosure, and we started looking for gang activity and found it in less than 2 weeks. So it's absolutely unbelievable that the open border policies allowed this high-level criminal network to come in, and then the government shipped children to them. And now the children are gone. So we know the children are not at the locations where they're going to look for them. Homeland Security, everybody's out there. They're door knocking. The kids, a lot of them are not at the place where they were said they were going, right? But interestingly, many of the traffickers themselves are at those places, because I have cases from 2021 that I worked and insiders that I was working with in 2024, and they gave the address that was the same place that the trafficker was. So what we believe needs to happen is now do a serious targeting operation on the sponsors themselves. Only a little over 400 sponsors have been arrested. And yet all these kids are gone? No. If you want to stop the drug trade in your neighborhood, will you go after the drug trafficker? If we want to stop the child trafficking, we need to go after the traffickers that are the sponsors. There should be serious criminal penalties for any sponsor who does not have possession of the child that they took into custody. Absolutely.
I want to talk about the data that they're currently looking at, because you are the expert on that front. You know, during the Fox piece, they announced that they are going through the data, and that's how their war room is trying to relocate these children and recover them. But you have a different angle on all of this, that there's different data that they should be focused on right now. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, and this, again, this is where DHS whistleblower Aaron Stevenson comes in. We submitted a white paper to the administration. We also attached a solution to my congressional testimony back in November. And we need a whole of government data analytics solution, not just looking at HHS data, but that data needs to be matched against all types of other data across other agencies. So, for example, we know that the trafficking ring in Bonita Springs, Florida, we know they were involved in various types of fraud, Social Security fraud. They had mortgage fraud. One person had 10 homes quit claimed into their name. And so how is this possible? And the children, when we use the data, like we can use the data, I help some of the reporters find where the children were. They were knocking on doors and children were telling them terrible stories like, you know, my sponsor tells me she's my aunt, but she's pimping me out for sex. you know, reporters have found kids in the Bonita Springs ring who said, we are being moved house to house to house every month. Mm-hmm. And line in the sand, which you are showing right there, James O'Keefe, when I was working, you know, with some of the people who he had undercover, the thing that we were able to show was that the exact same address was being used in 2021 and 2024. So the kids kept cycling out of there, but the trafficker was still there. So
it's absolutely egregious, Tara. It really is absolutely egregious. And I really hope we get a grip on this. And I'm happy that the administration is paying attention to this, but we really need them to ramp everything up and to reach out to your team, because this is an issue that's really something that needs to be resolved immediately. Tara, thank you for all the incredible work you continue to do. We appreciate your time as always.
Thank you, Brianna, for shining a light.
I'm jacked up on the Methylene Blue. It's the best thing you guys have ever had.
I do subscribe to the Methylene Blue and the Ultimate CMOS on a monthly basis. Take about 5-year supplements. So it's been helping me out for the last 3 years, lost 22 pounds. Feel better. I feel like I'm 25.
Like I said, I've been taking the Methylene Blue, and it is freaking awesome. I was honestly in the chat on Rumble bashing, like, getting sick of Alex plugging it. But I tell you what, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give it a try. I actually subscribe monthly now to it. And I got a couple other people that I work with. I gave them it, and they did the same thing.
I was so bad with the MS. I was in a wheelchair. That Methylene Blue is able to get everything that you're taking, all your antibiotics or whatever medicines you're taking, supplements. And what it does, it helps to cross the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. Methylene Blue will help things push it through to where it needs to go. I was at my store, and I keep the TV on at my store of InfoWars, and I heard Alex Jones talking about Methylene Blue. Well, right away, my ears perked up, because I knew what that did for me. I knew that it got me up and walking again, and I was having seizures without it, and I was bad, really bad. So I ordered it. I ordered 2 bottles of it, because you had to buy one, get one free. So I started taking it, and boy, let me tell you something. What a blessing. I take the capsules twice. I take 2 of those a day.
And you're saying with the Methylene Blue, you're taking it with ivermectin, and you're using our Methylene Blue, and it's kept you regress, but now you're taking this and you're back to being normal, or what's your level at
right now? I'm walking.
Okay.
No, I own a jewelry store, and I'm able to, and don't get me wrong, I have bad days.
Yeah.
But let me tell you something, I'm walking without a cane.
Okay.
And the bad days that I may have, maybe like once every couple weeks, but I'm able to speak properly, where my everything was lagging with me.
Right.
The lesions were showing very bright in my brain. And when I started on the Methylene Blue, which I couldn't take the liquid. I bought the liquid, but I just couldn't get it down. And I was trying to find like a concoction.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the pills came out. So I ordered the pills. I take 2 of those a day. I've been taking that with everything else, with the ivermectin. I take 1 pill a day of the ivermectin with the Methylene Blue. And I got to tell you, what a blessing. I am so blessed.
Well, that is great to hear. You know,
talk to you.
Because, you know, I'm glad to hear that. That really makes me feel good for, you know, the products that we offer to people. And, you know, the Methylene Blue, it really has been a game changer around here in terms of people getting it and seeing effects immediately, being able to acquire that quality of life they want. And that's really great to hear.
I will put money on it. Like I said, I used to have to pay $10,000 a week to get it in my arm and sit there for 6 hours a day to get it pumped in my system. And now I can take 2 pills or drink it once a day and pay what? I don't know. $30, $40 a bottle of it.
Depends on what the sale is,
And it's helping me to have a quality of life that I didn't have before that I have now. And I got to tell you, what a blessing. I don't care what anybody says. I know what it's like with it, and I know what it's like without it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for helping your family too, because, you know, sometimes people, they don't want to tell their family. They don't want to say anything because then, oh, you're supposed to mind your own business and not tell people about health. That's a doctor's job, you know, but no, it is our job to tell our families, hey, this is what I found out. This is what I found that works. Why don't you try it?
InfoWars. It was a rough week for the MAHA movement. We all had to sit by and watch as the big pharmaceutical companies put their little warriors out there to get RFK Jr. because they're not happy with the fact that he's representing medical freedom and trying to make America healthy again. But the one person that I know you can't stand, I can't stand, really put up quite the pretend match, I guess we'll just say, against RFK Jr. I mean, that's the best way to describe it, right? She really went in, thought she was doing an incredible job, and RFK Jr. put her in the spot. I will just let her take it away from here, and please accept my apologies. This is Elizabeth Warren trying her very best to go after RFK Jr.
You just changed the classification of the COVID vaccine.
I'm not taking them away from people, Senator.
It takes it away if you can't get it from your pharmacist.
Well, most Americans are going to be able to get it from their pharmacy for free.
$100.
Most Americans will be able to get it from their pharmacy
for free. The question is, everyone who wants it, that was your promise.
No, I didn't. I never promised that I was going to recommend products with which there is no indication.
When you said...
And I know you've taken $855,000 from pharmaceutical companies, Senator.
Did you hold up a big sign saying that you were lying when you said that? Because you are the one who said you would not take them away.
Oh, Warren. Well, it's a good thing that RFK Jr. didn't shy away from calling her out because she is just a prop of the big pharma machine. But folks, it didn't end there. We were forced to sit back and watch as President Trump welcomed Bill Gates to the White House. It was something that had a lot of us on edge. I don't even know how it happens. I don't even know how you validate this. Poor Melania. I hope he didn't shed on Melania. Folks, this is not what you want. This is not what we voted for. We definitely didn't vote for that. I know I didn't. Joining me to discuss is probably another guy who didn't vote for this either. Tom Renz joins the show. He's a great, incredible attorney fighting for medical freedom, and he's with us now. All right, Tom, it's been a kind of a rough week for MAHA, but thankfully we've got RFK Jr. out there slaying these big pharma rats who continue to pop up everywhere, even in the U.S. Senate. Elizabeth Warren trying her very best to go after RFK Jr., saying, you know, you promised. And RFK said, I never promised you anything, lady. Your reaction to what he had to endure on the Hill this week?
Oh, it's absolutely appalling. And the only thing worse than the people like Senator Warren are the people like Cassidy, the rhino sellouts that are pretending to be representatives of We the People, but who are really just sold out to Big Pharma. It's repulsive and appalling that we see leaked that there's a $2 million plan by Big Pharma to take Bobby out. And the first thing we do is with the Republican sellout all over the place, followed by Susie Weil setting up a dinner where Bill Gates can sit next to Trump and lecture us about mRNA and other poisons. And, this was absolutely appalling on every level. And topped off, if I can say, and I'm sorry to say this, God bless Donald Trump. We all love him. But for him to come out and question Florida pulling vaccine mandates, I mean, the one thing he's always been consistent about is that he doesn't believe in mandates. Now he's out there questioning that. Well, listen, if the vaccines work, Mr. President, why do I need to take them? Let the people who want them take them and let people like me say no.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tom, those who have taken it, I know for a fact, have a weakened immune system. You know, I was lightly joking with a friend of mine who took the vaccine and she was also boosted and she cannot stop getting sick. I have not gotten sick in years and I have not gotten the vaccine. And so she's just one of many people who continue to have these issues. And I'm also listening to folks citing the VAERS reports and saying, you know, this amount of people died from the vaccine, so it's not that bad. But the reality of it is, Tom, I know for a fact, because we had an issue in my family, that there's a lot of Americans who are injured by the vaccines, but the VAERS reports weren't filed by their doctors because they are afraid of Big Pharma coming after them for filing too many of these VAERS reports. Do you think VAERS is an accurate kind of portrayal of the success of these vaccines?
Well, we had the Harvard study that showed that only 1 out of 100 reports actually make it to VAERS. I can tell you that not only is it inaccurate, I can't even use it in a courtroom. VAERS is not considered accurate enough evidence for me to submit it as evidence in a courtroom. It's that bad. Everybody knows VAERS is a joke. Legally, you know, doctors are supposed to report. But look at what happened to the doctors that many of whom I defended during COVID. You know, they got drugged through the medical board just tyranny that occurred in every state. Look at our friend Mary Tyler Bowden and what she's been through. Look at Sherry Tenpenny, what she was through. I mean, there's so many people out there that were through hell. Of course they're not reporting things. They can't report things because the big pharma, medical board cabal will come after their license.
Yeah. Yeah. We've seen that time and time again. And all these fighters, these doctors who stuck their necks out, it's incredible that they did, but it came with a cost. And they're still fighting to regain a lot of those finances. I mean, a lot of these doctors were brutally attacked by the pharmaceutical companies in very creative lawfare ways. And it's absolutely disturbing. But you also mentioned, I wanted to get back to that point, President Trump criticizing Florida over its stance on not mandating a lot of these vaccines for children. We've got his response. Let's take a listen.
The vaccine mandates that were rolled back for school children. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we have to be very careful. Look, you have some vaccines that are so amazing. The polio vaccine, I happen to think, is amazing. A lot of people think that COVID is amazing. You know, there are many people that believe strongly in that. But you have some vaccines that are so incredible. And I think you have to be very careful when you say that some people don't have to be vaccinated. It's a very, you know, it's a very tough position. I'd give you an answer. I'll give you a feeling. But just initially, I heard about it yesterday, and it's a tough stance. Look, you have vaccines that work. They just pure and simple work. They're not controversial at all. And I think those vaccines should be used. Otherwise, some people are going to catch it, and they endanger other people.
Tom, we've got about 45 seconds, but I do want you to respond to that because that's a brutal stance to take up.
It's absurd on every level. There have been no gold standard studies for any mandated childhood vaccine. I've been through every single one of them myself. It's a lie. It's not true. There's a lot of controversy around every one of them. And again, I asked the president, if they work, how are other people going to get sick from them? I thought that they prevent the transmission of disease. If they don't, why should anybody take them? And for God's sakes, why, after all the lies that his buddy Bill Gates and some of these other people have put out in the last year or two, why would we ever trust them or Big Pharma for any data or evidence that they put forward? When do you trust a liar, Mr. President? When?
Yeah, Tom, it's disturbing to see, but thankfully we have you still in this fight. Tom Renz, thank you for all the incredible work you continue to do. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Brianna.
All right, folks, President Trump, you know, we could criticize him a bit, but he's also been doing incredible work, and he's signing away all of these executive orders. I'm talking about 200, right? So all members of Congress are sitting around not doing anything. He has signed 200 executive orders, and if I had to guess how many have been codified by Congress, I'd say less than a dozen. Less than a dozen. But I asked you all at home, what are some of your favorite executive orders signed by President Trump? And we got quite the interesting response so far. I see that Dan on X saying that naming the cartels as a terrorist group was one of his favorites. And I know there's a lot more of you guys who are over here talking about it as well. The Gulf of America was also announced on this tweet. The War Department. And as Ed says, all the ones on immigration. My personal favorite thus far, though, has to be making English the official language of the United States. Folks, sound off on Twitter. Give me a follow at Brianna Morello. We've got a jam-packed program still heading your way, so do not go anywhere. I'll be right back.
I'm jacked up on the Methylene Blue. It's the best thing you guys have ever had.
I do subscribe to the Methylene Blue and the Ultimate Sea Moss on a monthly basis. Take about 5-year supplements. So it's been helping me out for the last 3 years, the last 22 pounds. Feel better. I feel like I'm 25.
Like I said, I've been taking the Methylene Blue, and it is freaking awesome. I was honestly in the chat on Rumble bashing, like, getting sick of Alex plugging it. But I tell you what, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give it a try. I feel I actually subscribe monthly now to it, and I got a couple other people that I work with. I gave them it, and they did the same thing.
I was so bad with the MS. I was in a wheelchair. That Methylene Blue is able to get everything that you're taking, all your antibiotics or whatever medicines you're taking, supplements. And what it does, it helps to cross the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. Methylene Blue will help things push it through to where it needs to go. I was at my store, and I keep the TV on at my store of InfoWars, and I heard Alex Jones talking about methylene blue. Right away, my ears perked up because I knew what that did for me. I knew that it got me up and walking again, and I was having seizures without it, and I was bad, really bad. So I ordered it. I ordered 2 bottles of it because you had to buy one, get one free. So I started taking it, and boy, let me tell you something. What a blessing. I take the capsules twice. I take 2 of those a day.
And you're saying with the methylene blue, you're taking it with ivermectin, and you're using our methylene blue, and it's kept you regressed, but now you're taking this, and you're back to being normal, or what's your level at?
I'm
right
walking.
Now? Okay.
No, I'm. You know, I own a jewelry store, and I'm able to. Don't get me wrong. I have bad days.
Yeah.
But let me tell you something. I'm walking without a cane.
Okay.
And the bad days that I may have, maybe like once every couple weeks. But I'm able to speak properly where my everything was lagging with me.
Right.
The lesions were showing very bright in my brain. And when I started on the methylene blue, which I couldn't take the liquid. I bought the liquid, but I just couldn't get it down. And I was trying to find like a concoction.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the pills came out. So I ordered the pills. I take 2 of those a day. I've been taking that with everything else, with the ivermectin. I take 1 pill a day of the ivermectin with the methylene blue. And I got to tell you, what a blessing. I am so blessed.
Well, that's great to hear.
To talk to you.
Because, I'm glad to hear that. That really makes me feel good for, the products that we offer to people. And, the methylene blue, it really has been a game changer around here in terms of people getting it and seeing effects immediately, being able to to acquire that quality of life they want. And that's really great to hear.
I will put money on it. Like I said, I used to have to pay $10,000 a week to get it in my arm and sit there for 6 hours a day to get it pumped in my system. And now I can take 2 pills or drink it once a day and pay what? I don't know. $30, $40 a bottle of it.
Depends on what the sale is,
And it's helping me to have a quality of life that I didn't have before that I have now. And I got to tell you, what a blessing. I don't care what anybody says. I know what it's like with it, and I know what it's like without it.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you
for helping your family too, because, sometimes people, they don't want to tell their family. They don't want to say anything because then, you're supposed to mind your own business and not tell people about health. That's a doctor's job, but no, it is our job to tell our families, hey, this is what I found out. This is what I found that works. Why don't you try it?
InfoWars, your source for uncensored truth this morning, is Brianna Morello.
Risen gates won't open up for me. On these hands and knees, I'm crawling.
Good morning, InfoWars. A lot going on in the world. I want to make sure that your focus is on all the key issues. And we wanted to also say some positive things about the Trump administration. President Trump isn't afraid to call out the lawfare, and we're thankful for that. He just recently went public about former Mesa County clerk and record keeper, Tina Peters. Many of you guys know Tina Peters was sentenced to 9 years in prison. She is an amazing woman. I've had the pleasure of meeting her personally, and it was devastating to see as Colorado sent her away to prison. She is charged right now on the state level, but President Trump isn't forgetting about her. She was the one who wanted to call out and to expose the alleged election fraud in her area. So, when she did that, of course, she didn't make the people very happy who were in charge of all of this, and they threw her in prison for 9 years. It's absolutely egregious, but President Trump is still fighting for her and still bringing up her name. Take a listen.
They arrested her instead of the people that did the cheating. It's a state charge, so it's hard to do anything with, but we're gonna do something. What they did in Colorado. Look, Colorado just went to all mail-in voting. That means they cheat. That's why they lost, that's one of the reasons, but that's a big reason why they just lost the whole Space Command situation that is going to Alabama. But when you have mail-in voting, you have nothing but cheating. But this woman is a real patriot. And they put her in jail for a long time. She's 72 years old, 73 years old. And she wanted to find out. She didn't do anything. She touched the machine. She looked at the machine. She's trying to find out what was going on. And they went and arrested her for doing that. And it was supposed to be the other way around. I'm glad you brought that up.
We're glad that President Trump brought that up as well. He continues to post about it on Truth Social. And his pardon attorney, Mr. Ed Martin, is also bringing up Tina Peters, saying, I just spoke with Tina Peters from her prison cell. What a privilege. What a lady. God bless her. Tina, we are coming for you. Folks, this is really important because Tina Peters, again, she's charged on a state level, so this is going to be a heck of a fight. But it's one that's worth taking on. But if President Trump wants to free the political prisoners that we have in this country, there's an even easier fight that he could take on, like those who were the victims of the Governor Whitmer kidnapping plot. I'm talking about that cooked up hoax by the FBI under the Biden regime. As many of you guys know, there were more FBI informants and people working for the FBI than there were individuals who were trying to kidnap Whitmer. Now, we've never gotten any answers as to why they even did this in the first place, but there are two individuals currently sitting in federal prison right now who could be pardoned at any point. I'm talking about Barry Koft as well as Adam Fox. Barry was sentenced to 235 months in prison, and Adam Fox was sentenced to 16 years in prison. Now, I've brought this issue up several times on my show because these two men cannot be forgotten. I even asked Ed Martin, the pardon attorney, that when he was on my program. Take a listen. Looking into this case and possibly pardoning these two individuals.
Well, thank you, Brianna, and thanks for being on this in the past as well as now. I think that the question of Michigan and what went on with this, you know, fednapping, question is one that it falls into two categories. One, I agree with you. There's a weaponization of government, you know, very, very suspect. The timing, how it was rolled out, what exactly went on, and we need to get to the bottom of that. And yes, that's in my weaponization working group as a topic, something that we're looking at, and I'll be looking at closely. But on the pardon front, we can't leave these guys behind. In my opinion, these are victims just like January 6th, and so we are processing that, and I have complete confidence that we're going to get a hard look at it, and the president will want to know the facts about it, want to see the relationship.
And that was back in May. Ed Martin brave enough to speak out on the issue, and it's really important that he does. And that even made national headlines because Whitmer wasn't happy when she heard that. So that probably means that's the right take. Joining me to discuss is the only independent journalist who has been fighting for these men and other defendants as well. Joining me is Christina Urso. She is a credible independent journalist, and she is with us now. Christina, I'm glad you're here. I know we spoke about my interview with Ed Martin, and you've been talking to the guys as they sit in federal prison. First off, how are they doing? And I know there's an update also in Adam's case as well.
They're holding up. They are at Florence Supermax, though, so it's a difficult position, and it's still difficult to communicate with them. But they, hearing Ed Martin talk about their case has made them hopeful that something will happen.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because Ed Martin, I know he's a fighter. He's advocating for this. He's someone who's pushing forward on this front. He's been incredible when it comes to being the pardon attorney, even taking on now special prosecutor as well. So I'm hopeful that this is going to happen. Adam Fox, I know you said to me privately that there was an update in his case. What was that specifically?
Well, right now, Adam does not even have any legal representation. So after he and Barry's appeals were denied by the Sixth Circuit, he requested a new attorney because his court-appointed appeals lawyer sabotaged his case on purpose. And the Sixth Circuit denied him a new lawyer, and then they sent the denial to Newaygo County, where he hasn't been in 2 years. He's at Florence Supermax, so he didn't even get that denial. And so right now, Barry Koft is appealing to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, but there is a less than 1% chance that the Supreme Court will even look at it. And Adam has nobody appealing to the Supreme Court. He's already missed that deadline. But what I can say is that his trial lawyer has filed a petition for pardon So hopefully that will help move things along and we can look at maybe getting these guys out. And I think that they both are worthy of pardons. And we also can't forget the three state guys who are on state charges in the state of Michigan right now, currently trying to appeal their wrongful convictions as well.
Yeah. Well, this would be an easy fix for the Trump administration to free at least these two men first. And then that would bring the attention for the other three and apply a little pressure to the governor, because it's egregious that this happened in the first place. But Christina, not many people, I think, understand the depths that this all went to. And I know there's so much in regards to the FBI's role in this hoax. But some brief overview, because we got about 2 minutes and I'm going to let you take the floor from here. Can you map out what the FBI's role in all of this was? Because they played a significant role in this plot.
Sure. There was no plot, I should say, from the beginning, except on the part of the FBI. What happened here was you had a prepping group online that was infiltrated by an FBI informant who took over the group and became effectively the leader of the Wolverine Watchmen. You had another FBI informant, a child predator, who was pretending that he was running a national 3%er militia group that was actually being run by the FBI. They used a network of 12 informants in this case to really manufacture the appearance of something happening that wasn't happening. And they did this over the course of almost a year, befriending these men, holding militia meetings and field training exercises. And we have to remember what was happening at the time. We were under unconstitutional lockdown orders, and we also saw rioting across the country. As that was happening, these men were looking to train their skills so they could protect their families, their communities. And they also wanted to network with other militia guys to talk about what was happening in their state. So the FBI literally trained these men, put on field training exercises, invited these men to the exercises, picked them up, furnished them with alcohol and marijuana, and then would just ask them hypothetical questions while filming them running through an obstacle course that the FBI set up. All the while, Whitmer was fully aware of the investigation. The FBI is the one that organized the recons of Whitmer's vacation cottage, which was literally just the FBI picking people up in a vehicle, driving them down the street of her vacation cottage, and then instructing people to take pictures that would then be used against them later. Every single aspect of the case was manufactured, created by the FBI, and then these men were deprived the right to a fair trial. They were prevented from introducing exculpatory evidence, and any witnesses were threatened with charges as well.
Christina Urso, you're doing an incredible job exposing all of this. Give her a follow on X, because you're going to be releasing a documentary on this very, very soon, and we look forward to just that. Christina, thank you for speaking up for these men. Not many people, actually, I think you're the only person who's doing it, and so we're very grateful for just that. Again, folks, give her a follow on X. We've got more on the way. You're not going to miss the next segment. I promise you that.
The last 5 years, I've had all these scientists on promoting spike protein detoxes that have saved so many people and done all this. And finally, we're like, hey, we better do our own. Let's make the best. We take the two best-selling ones, combine the two with stuff that the government tried to ban so people would die. And yeah, we're selling stuff that really works. Tell us about Ultimate Life Force. It's a horse pill. I take it a few times a year as a detox. So good for cardiovascular. Just one of the ingredients in this alone is on record a game changer they tried to ban.
Right.
This is so important.
N-acetylcysteine, better known as NAC, was widely available pre-pandemic, but during the pandemic, during COVID, they took it off Amazon because it was too powerful. Too many people were getting well from it. They say, okay, this isn't a supplement. This is a drug. Now, we're not making that claim this is a supplement, but it is a supplement that is so powerful it could be used and compared to something like that.
And what is NAC?
N-acetylcysteine is the main precursor to your body's master antioxidant, glutathione, right? Glutathione is what your body uses to detoxify everything, but most importantly, your lungs. NAC reduces lung mucus and is incredibly powerful. This is rocket fuel. This is the gasoline. This is the fuel you need to make the glutathione. But more importantly, even than that almost, I was taking a look at Ultimate Life Force, and I forget about these things. These things are something that they wanted to ban even more, the natokinase and the serapeptase. Those are compounds that go in and break down blood clots and scar tissue and inorganic things in the body. That's for the spike protein. The cool thing is everybody, every human can get healthy. It just takes different specific steps to get healthy. And that's why becoming knowledgeable about...
Well, that's like breeds of cows. They're like, these cows can handle the heat, these cows can't. These cows can handle cold, they can't. These dogs can handle this, these can't. We're all dogs, we're all cows, we're all the same species, but there's certain things each group can't handle.
100%, I agree with that. And it's so key. I mean, the reason why Methylene Blue has just been such an incredible hit to the audience and to the supporters, listeners, to us, everyone, is because, well, like, we really feel the effect, you know?
It's like the Garden of Eden. God made all these things to work together.
It's all there. The information's readily
available. No, it's absolutely incredible. These are great products. They fund the operation. And, folks, it's common sense. Go get them. TheAlexShowStore.com. Get the bovine colostrum, get the methyl drive, get the power plant, get the methylene blue, get it all.
What's cool about supplements, at least to me, is you're able to look at these different genetic groups, and then you can go, okay, they need help with this one thing, we got a compound for that.
All we did was go out with the top selling products of all the studies and just combine them together.
100%. And I mean, you look at this product, the NAC alone makes it worth buying, but you've got four or five other things in there directly targeted to addressing COVID and long COVID.
People say, well, I don't have COVID right now. The point is, it's good for you, period.
100%. We've all got scar tissue in us. We've all got issues. We've all got these inorganic compounds, these microplastics. We look at something like Ultimate Life Force, it might be able to address some of those situations. You look at this, you look at the other products we're offering you, it's kind of hard to do an individual pitch for them because they're all so amazing. It's incredible. We make this stuff for you and for ourselves. Everyone at the InfoWars office is gobbling these supplements left and right. That's why I made these, is so I could take them.
And then you designed it to go with our Ultra Methylene Blue.
Absolutely. That's the key. Before any, like, man or woman, young and old, if you're on Methylene Blue, you got to take it.
Everybody loves the formulas, and I've noticed if I take both together, the energy is totally insane. Each one is very strong on its own.
Methyl Drive is something that every person in the country should take. This is something so powerful they tried to ban it.
So the Methylene Blue is like the engine and gasoline. These products together is a nitrous oxide.
Exactly. It turbocharges.
InfoWars. All right, so I've got some kind of sad news because it's personal. I am a New Yorker, and to sit back and watch New York City surrender to potentially a communist is absolutely gut-wrenching. You may have heard his name. His name is Zohran Mamdani. He is running to be the mayor of New York City. And as if New York City wasn't enough of a cesspool as is, it's going to get worse. It's going to get a lot worse. He is probably going to be the winner, given the fact that the Republican candidate, not a strong candidate, has a history of losing. And he's up against Eric Adams, who obviously they don't really like anymore. And then the other one is the nursing home killer, Andrew Cuomo. So it's not looking good for New York City. But folks, people want to kind of focus on his religion rather than the fact that he's a communist. It's scary. It's horrifying. But the reality is New York is a very liberal city. And so if you really want to save New York, you got to stop talking about Islam. You got to stop talking about his ties to Islam right now. You have to focus on the fact that he's a communist. And I keep telling people this all the time. He is a communist. Say it loud, because the mainstream media is propping him up. I'm talking about the outlets like CNN, MSNBC. I mean, he's making the rounds. He's becoming a national figure right now. And it's pretty sickening to sit back and watch. Now, he did join CNN yesterday to talk about the idea of Elon Musk potentially becoming a trillionaire. Now, listen to his response to the question, because he's pretending to be this loving, caring person who cares about the working class, but he doesn't really care about them.
This country, there's a big debate about the wealthy, the uber wealthy, the gap between the rich and the poor. Just this week, Tesla offered a pay package to Elon Musk that would potentially make him a trillionaire. Do you think trillionaires should exist?
I think the better question is whether working people should exist, because what we're seeing right now is amidst this incredible wealth, we have people who are keeping the city running that have to now live outside of the city, outside of the state. There are New Yorkers who are living in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Connecticut because they just can't afford to live here. Amidst all of that, we have talk of trillionaires. I mean, it tells you where our political priorities are. And that's what is so frustrating, is that when we talk about the cuts to SNAP benefits here in New York City, the throwing of millions off of their health insurance, it's not just a incident that has taken place in Washington, D.C. It is a function of the largest wealth transfer we've ever seen in our history of our country's politics.
Let's be clear. I don't care if you're a trillionaire, billionaire, millionaire. I believe that you should be able to exist. I don't think communists should be able to exist, though, especially in the United States. Now, it's becoming extremely frustrating to sit back and watch that man pretend like he is a caring person for the working class, even though he's never had a job before. He is someone who has been propped up, who has a very interesting father as well, and it's extremely disturbing. So, folks, if you're going to start talking about this issue, I highly, highly recommend steer clear of the Islam angle, because it's a very left-wing area. So those who might maybe fear communism might take you up on that angle rather than the Islam angle, because we all saw what happened when we did that with Barack Obama. Okay, let's turn to the next topic, because this one is a very, very interesting one. I'm talking about Google. So Google is, obviously you guys both know that they are very biased. And that's putting it nicely. But President Trump yesterday went out and decided to threaten the EU because they had just fined the American company $3.5 billion. Now, if you're wondering why they fined them, it's because they pretty much are accused of running a monopoly. Now, here in the United States, we have actually just ruled that they are running an illegal monopoly. And it's been very, very interesting, because that started under the Trump administration, that lawsuit. Back in 2020, the Trump administration went after Google for running an illegal monopoly, and then a judge in D.C. ruled in favor of the DOJ. But the details regarding the penalties have been quite interesting, because most conservatives say it doesn't go far enough. Now, those details were just recently released this week, and I got my hands on an exclusive with the woman who took on Google. I'm talking about Gail Slater. She is currently running the DOJ's antitrust division, and she joined me to react to the penalties. Take a listen. A lot of critics, they're very critical on the aspect that this doesn't divest Chrome. As many of you guys at home know, Google does own Chrome. And so I know a lot of people, especially on the conservative side of things, were hoping to kind of break that up a bit. What do you say to your critics who say this doesn't go far enough?
Listen, we're not happy with the whole agreement. And of course, we are weighing our options. We have a right of appeal. Google has a right of appeal. We're not there yet. This is a 200 plus page opinion. So you can imagine there's a lot to digest and read in there. So we're thinking carefully about what the future looks like, as are critics outside the building. There are always critics. They'll always be with us. This is the American way. And it's good to have a healthy debate about these things. Look, the goal here was to unleash data, to put it in the hands of competitors, and to look to the future. And importantly, these remedies apply as much to online search today as to artificial intelligence in the future. And so we think that's really, really important. And so we're looking at these remedies as a positive. We can think about Chrome. We can think about how much faster data would be unleashed if Chrome had been divested. But we're not there yet in terms of what levers we might pull in that regard.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for folks at home to know that the possibility of an appeal, it is possible, and it's something that you guys are potentially looking at. Is that correct?
Yes, that's fair to say.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. All right, it was very good to hear from Gail Slater. If you want to listen to the full interview, it is up right now on band.video. Definitely check that out. I want to get to my next guest, because he is traveling all across the state of Florida, and he's catching predators. Please welcome to the show, Alex Rosen. Alex, obviously out here fighting the good fight in the beautiful state of Florida. Alex, it's been a very busy day for you. I know yesterday you caught three alleged predators. One of those, we believe, was actually a Disney employee. I reached out to Disney for comments, and Disney telling me that they don't think he's an employee of theirs, and denying that he's an employee, in fact. But his Facebook page says he works for Disney. So bring us the latest on this.
Yeah, so we caught three predators yesterday, one of them being named Benjamin Walker in Haines City, Florida. He came to meet who he thought was a 13-year-old boy. And, yeah, he was very, very graphic in the messages, offered to send child porn multiple times, and, of course, wanted to have sex, brought lube and condoms for this kid. And we interviewed him, and he said he's viewed child pornography as young as 2 years old. Confirmed that he does, in fact, work at Disney. He told the kid he works at Disney that he was talking to, and said he met his wife at Disney. He said he's a cook at Disney. And I don't know why Disney's denying he works there. I mean, I have no clue why. I mean, he said he called off the day he met the kid, which was yesterday. And, yeah, and, you know, Haines City Police, they cuffed him. They took his phone. I don't think he's been formally charged yet, but he is 100% going to go down for child pornography. Once the cops go through that phone, he's screwed.
Yeah, Alex, and that's the common theme here. And this is what I grilled Disney on. And I know I sent you a screenshot to show you that they denied these claims. But I asked Disney, because they continuously have individuals who work for them get arrested in these stings all across Florida, but mostly Polk County. They've caught four, three, two. I mean, they just catch them all the time. Why do you think Disney has this problem? Because they didn't want to answer when I asked them.
Well, I mean, he's actually the second Disney employee we've caught, the first one we've caught in Polk County. It is a very common theme. I think the reason is because a lot of these people that work at Disney, especially, you know, dressing up in the costumes and stuff, they never grow out of their childhood phase. And I think, you know, that immaturity and, they're stunted in a lot of ways, including with their attraction to kids. So I think they relate to kids more. They just see them as more attractive. And that's what brings them to Disney. I mean, it's just basically a place where they never have to grow up.
Yeah, it's pretty vile. And it makes one, if you have kids, not want to go to the parks itself, because again, this is a continuous issue that goes on. But let's shift gears a little bit. I know you're also catching other predators. There was one who is an alleged British pedo, Ross Glimley. I hope I'm saying his name right. Break down the latest here, because he was there to meet a 13-year-old girl, according to you.
Yeah, so Ross is the second British pedo we've caught in the past month. I don't know what it is with these British people moving to, like, you know, the country in Florida and Texas or whatever. But, yeah, he was there to meet a 13-year-old girl for sex. He said he hasn't had sex in 9 years, but that's not just the reason he's there. He said he's also viewed child pornography of 8-year-old girls, has had tons of underage kids send him nudes online. He's a huge danger, and there's a huge concern because he has custody of his 9-year-old daughter, and he's a single dad. So I hope there's nothing going on with that. But yeah, he was pretty blatant. He was waiting at the park for like 30, 40 minutes for us to show up. And, yeah, he wasn't too happy about getting arrested. It took four cops to put him in cuffs, so he was not thrilled with that.
It's egregious. It is egregious. Alex, you're doing an incredible job, Predator Poachers team as well, at getting these creeps off of our streets. And it's unfortunate that law enforcement's not doing enough, but we want to thank you for all of your incredible work. Folks, head over to his X page, subscribe, because that's how you fund these operations. I Fight for Kids. Thank you so much, as always, Alex. He's on the road, and he's catching these predators. Folks, it's been an incredible way to start your morning, I have to say, on this program. I'm glad you decided to join us. I'll be back, of course, with plenty more headlines that the mainstream media is never going to tell you about because they are afraid to do just that. But for now, give me a follow on X at Brianna Morello, and have a great rest of your weekend.
We'll join our regularly scheduled program after these messages.
I saw this a few weeks ago. We got it done. That young girl that is the return of the British queen that fought the Romans, Boudica. Look at this. The West awakens. Look at this badass shirt, ladies and gentlemen. It's got a red InfoWars over the heart on the left, and then it's got her on the back. I designed this shirt. I think it's amazing. The West awakens 2025. This is a badass shirt, and it literally funds people totally committed to freedom. Then we've got Virtue Signal, and it's the Cracker Barrel symbol right there that we updated there. So we got that. We've also got another, The West Awakens, with the hatchet and the butcher knife, ladies and gentlemen. Get them now at theyellowstonestore.com. But what you really want is the ultramethylene blue, the Shilajit, the Irish sea moss, all of it massively discounted, 25% off across the store, apparel, all of it. We've got buy one bottle already discounted, the Shilajit or the Atomic Defense Immune Boost, and get another bottle half off. The point is, we got War Bonds. That's a nice little piece of art you get with my face on it. You get $110 for $100. It's mailed to you as a promo code on it for the site. But everybody that becomes a VIP, $30 a month, something like Amazon Prime, you get $40 to spend each month right when you pay that. You cancel any time, get a special deal, special offer, special sales. I need your support. Wars aren't cheap. So what do good salesmen do? They sell good products. You are insane if you don't get our Methylene Blue. You are crazy if you don't get our Ultimate Life Force Blood Detox. It's all there at TheAlexJonesStore.com. Take action now and get these new limited edition shirts like the F Around Find Out.
Now, back to our program.
So here it is. Onion CEO Ben Collins, that ran the censorship bureau at MSNBC, now funded by Bloomberg, hasn't given up on print or buying InfoWars. And you ought to read the whole, 22-page article, because it is a exercise in disinformation and gobbledygook.
It became immediately clear to us that no one else was going to bid on this. The auction for these assets, like the entirety of the InfoWars thing, like including his supplements that he sells to people, were for sale. Like, we won, the judge took it away from us because he was also scared of what was going on. And
no, they had a fake auction and got caught, and the judge said it violated bankruptcy law. He didn't want to say it was criminal, but he said it, you know. He stopped short, but he said, it looks bad.
You made this bid. It was an incredible moment when it was announced that you were doing this. And then all of a sudden, brakes are on, right? And a judge somewhere, I have all the details, but basically said, this isn't happening.
Yeah. He basically wiped away about like 18 months of court decisions. It was like, I would be spooked too. You got to remember, right? Dan Bongino, Cash Patel, these people were on InfoWars.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Patel never was.
Our ideological battle in our generation is not what we went through in the Civil War, defending the country and abolishing the scourge of slavery. It's not our revolution where we fought for the very ideas of limited government freedom. That's not it. What we're fighting now is an ideology, a pernicious, dangerous, and historically deadly ideology that says that other men and women have been imbued with some special powers to reign over your life and take your liberty. And to move forward, and this is somehow a benevolent way, knighted by the Lord himself, that these men should take control of your life. This is our fight. This is our time.
Once we allow the left-leaning media, which is what most of them are, to paint conservative or liberty-based talk as inherently violent, what do you think the next step is, Alex? The next step is censorship. You can't allow this to happen. So I'm asking your listeners whether you support Trump, Cruz, Rubio, Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Joey Bag of Donuts, I don't care who you support. Do not allow them to do this, because once they do it, it's the next step towards suppression of free speech, which the left has always...
And as usual, you cut right to the heart. They're censoring in Europe. They're starting to censor here. They admit they want to censor us because they can't compete with our ideas. And you hit the nail on the head. They are wanting to say it's radical. They want to put out these law enforcement advisements. They even tried to ban in the Navy the Gadsden flag that was the first flag of the U.S. Navy. They mean business. Right.
Like, Dan Bongino, you got to start there. These people, that was a feeder system to the administration. So, to be afraid of that is natural.
Now, at the end here, they say, if you could have anything you wanted, what would you do?
What would you control?
I really would like to control InfoWars.
No, that's a good answer.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens, but I would like to do it.
The more we survive, the more we know it's the hand of God, and the more historical it is, and the more it makes me love this place more than ever and want to fight. Because they want the symbol, and they want to misrepresent, and they want to steal not just my identity, but the idea of the InfoWar, and claim it's theirs. And they say that on national TV and in Wired Magazine and all over the place. And they got caught in a fake auction. And we sued them and got the depositions and emails where they admit, we're not going to let any company that keeps Jones on the air and InfoWars have it. So we're just going to we're going to cancel the auction and give it to these people. Well, guess what? The Justice Department's investigating now. And here they are in there. In Wired admitting they know that, and then they've got the nerve in this Wired magazine article to say the judge is scared of the Justice Department, and that's why he hasn't given us the company. The judge has nothing to worry about. And then they've got these people literally spinning it. Oh, Jones has Dan Bongino stopping the shutdown. In June of last year, the judge shut them down when they tried to close this illegally. And he fired the U.S. trustee from the Justice Department. They brought another one and the CRO saying never seen anything like it. Then in November, they had the fake auction and he shut them down then. That had nothing to do with Dan Bongino. So just know, if they somehow get us shut down the next few months, which they're trying to do constantly, there's another hearing on the 16th in front of Guerra Gamble that ran the show trials. It'll work out, folks, because if people don't get indicted for what they've done that's cut and dry, I mean cut and dry, in the depositions, in the emails, we're not going to let anybody at the auction get InfoWars. We're going to go beforehand, decide it goes to this group for almost no money. That's bankruptcy fraud.
The ancient blue wizard is who I be. The magic of Methylene flows through me. His wars of info have gone through the ages to keep your minds locked in cages. Break free from the lies and save your soul, or the demonic agenda shall reach its goal.
Upon this field, with steel in hand, I guard the truth across the land. No tyrant's crown, no foreign laws shall pierce the shield of InfoWars. This dagger's point, both sharp and true, defends the rights for me and you. So grab your phone without delay, and go to the website if you may. Order your dagger to stand in the fight, before the globalists turn out the lights.
Other networks lie to you about what's happening now. InfoWars tells you the truth about what's happening next. Visit InfoWars.com/show and share the link today.
All right, we're going to be here for a while. You might as well get cozy. Like and subscribe. Join the Discord, the Minecraft server, follow the Instagram. Now let's dive. The entrance to this whole rabbit hole begins with the October the 1st police reporting of the events that evening. Most specifically that Steven had fired over 1,100 rounds into the crowd of concertgoers that night. And yet, that really can't be true from what we see. Based on the police report photos we do have, there are nowhere near 1,100 bullet casings in that room. And from what we are told, the bullets should have easily landed in a pretty convenient pile for the police to count. And very few, if any, should have fallen outside the window, based on where it is assumed Stephen had been standing and shooting from. Therefore, one must ask, why aren't there the appropriate number of bullet casings in the room, and how did the police come to that number? I sure would like to know, but it doesn't seem like the police actually tell us so in their report. Indeed, from my estimation, there are some 400 bullets in all the photos combined of all of Steven's rooms, which would then be roughly 700 shy of what was originally stated that he had fired. So, what's going on then? Because along with a lack of shell casings, there is way too much ammunition in Steven's room to make the argument that he was only there for the concert. The final police report states that there were roughly 5,500 rounds of unfired ammunition in Steven's room, which, basic math time, is about 5 times the number of rounds he had allegedly fired into the crowd. Further, as mentioned, Steven had left a bunch of ammunition in the car, which doesn't make sense either because it won't be much use to you down there if you're up in your hotel room. Furthermore, it's not as though Steven was raided by the SWAT just as his shooting commenced, and he didn't have enough time to finish firing the rest of that ammo, in which case it might make sense why there's so much. In fact, which we briefly touched upon earlier in another episode, Steven had over 72 minutes, as we previously discussed, between when the shooting ended and the SWAT actually entered his room. And based on the impossibly fast fire rate of Steven Paddock that he allegedly showed us that evening, these 72 minutes would have been more than enough time to shoot off the other 5,500 rounds of ammunition. Furthermore, in Paddock's care, they also found over 100 pounds of Tannerite. Tannerite being a medium tier explosive that you can buy at a lot of gun stores. And yet he didn't bring that up with him either, or rig a bomb to explode at a certain time. It was literally just sitting there, still in its package from what I could tell. Which makes no sense, because why have the Tannerite but not be prepared to use it? Fortunately, we do have it on good knowledge that Stephen was an arms dealer, as we've covered before, and yet that still brings to mind something that doesn't add up. All of these wasted supplies so neatly packed away in luggage, clearly this was done to make the transfer of goods more expedient and covert, But then why was it left there? That is a question we may never know the answer to, but for our sake, it's probably best it was left there because when you look at the ammo a little bit more deeply, there are some phenomena one might notice. As some types of ammunition would be just plain weird to use if you were plotting a shooting of a concert like Paddock had allegedly been doing. And indeed, once again, Stephen will prove to be a very unique man because the robust stash of ammo he had brought with him was red tip, which typically denotes a tracer round. And from what we have seen of the footage from that evening, there are no muzzle flashes nor tracer rounds emanating from Stephen's room. To our knowledge, I should say. Especially since you know the SWAT says the windows weren't broken.
We do not have a broken window.
Okay.
Stand by. We've got curtains open on a window that's not broken.
But was further strange that, say, Stephen somehow was shooting through the unbroken windows? Well, in that evening should have looked way, way different. Because this is what a tracer round looks like. And this is what a tracer round looks like at night. And based on the remaining ammo, we can assume that tracers would have been basically all Stephen had to shoot. Thus, the evening should have looked much different on camera than it did. And it should have taken the cops no time to find and breach Stephen's room. The light that night would have looked like a fireworks show, but lethal. As discussed in the first episode, Jesus Campos is the incredibly suspicious security guard and only eyewitness to the shooting. Among many things, he states that he took a bullet to the leg, despite video directly disproving that. Jesus would go on to completely disappear for about a week, bailing without notice on the over 12 interviews on air and written that he had scheduled himself. And after his appearance, he reemerged only to appear on the Ellen DeGeneres show, of all places, where he gave a very scripted appearing interview where Ellen says for him the following statement.
I know that you... First of all, you know, thank you so much for being here, and I know that you've had so many people asking for you to tell the story and to talk about this, and I understand your reluctance because you just want this to be over. So you're talking about it now, and then you're not going to talk about it again, and I don't blame you because why relive this over and over again? But it's helpful for people to understand what a hero you are because you, being shot in the leg, saved so many people's lives.
The whole thing is bizarre, and based on the available evidence, Campos' silence was likely purchased by MGM. I'm not going to bore anyone by repeating myself. If you are curious, definitely go check out the first episode. But at the time of researching for that video, what I did not know is that MGM chose to put Jesus Campos on the Ellen DeGeneres show for a very specific reason. The Ellen show is, for all intents and purposes, a low-tier, quote-unquote, comedy show that has zero reason to be hosting such a guest. Or so I thought in my ignorance. But there is no such thing as coincidence, thus putting my ear to the streets, I did some searching and discovered that, shocker, Ellen is owned by MGM. Explaining why Jesus is on the show and why he was never asked a question about the change in timeline or why he was supposedly shot 6 minutes before the gunfire began on the concert or why he disappeared. He and his handler, colleague, even get free tickets to watch men in tights slap each other and play over a ball and a donation made in their honor to their specific charity, which was the compromise after refusing to accept money, ironically enough. Clearly, it was a softball interview meant to quell the concerns about what happened that night, but Cooper, you didn't answer what you mean by MGM owning Ellen. Owns, I should say, I mean in the proverbial sense, as they make a fortune offer. In 2015, they released a whole slew of Ellen DeGeneres themed slot machines that Ellen obviously takes royalties on. Not the sort of thing you want to risk losing out on, both from the casino's perspective and hers. Which would make sense then why MGM chose to have Campos on Ellen. She's owned media, won't ask questions, and will help ease the public curiosity about what occurred the night of October the 1st of 2017. But it does get stranger. Her production company, named A Very Good Production, which is just false advertising, was operated at the time of the shooting by a man named Jeff Kleeman. Jeff, however, didn't always work for Ellen. He also spent over a decade working in various production and executive roles at MGM. So it seems that the ties between Ellen and MGM are tighter than we could have imagined. And speaking of odd coincidences as it relates to financial incentives, there is an interesting fellow named James Moran, who at the time of the Vegas shooting was the CEO of MGM Resorts International, the parent company of Mandalay Bay and a bunch of other properties. The sort of guy who is in the know about all sorts of things and important event-related information about his company and what's going on at any time, which makes his behavior in the months and weeks prior to the shooting so suspicious. In the midst of a booming rise of MGM stock, where for months the market was bullish, and investors were suggesting this was a great time to buy, the CEO of the company sold off much of his stock, which he had accumulated during his time at the helm. Not just a few shares, but 294,150 to be precise, or about 80% of his total ownership of the company. He made about $10 million on this transaction, which is nothing to scoff at. But it's even more curious because that sell-off wasn't just in the midst of an upward growth trajectory, but it was just 23 days before Stephen Paddock allegedly opened fire. The timing, we're not gonna lie, is too exceptional to merely be a coincidence in my mind, especially considering Moran stood to miss out on roughly $1.7 million of stock value had he sold after the shooting. Incriminating for certain, however, it seems that Moran couldn't keep mum on the word and may have let it leak to a bigger fish. George Soros, the embodiment of a demon, the incarnation of evil in the form of a vile, elderly husk, he also happened to be under the impression that MGM Resorts, while in a bullish upward climb, was a worthwhile short position to open. Short meaning he was in essence wagering the price of MGM Resorts International stock was going to drop considerably enough to make a profit on the difference. In fact, he was so confident in this bet that he opened a short position on 1.35 million shares of MGMRI. Guess what? This position was reported in August, no more than about 60 days prior to the shooting. That many shares at August of 2017 prices makes Soros' position a roughly $42 million one. And as we know, MGMRI's price did go down shortly afterwards, with Soros collecting a $73 million return on his investment. All of which makes one wonder where these two got their information from. How could they be so confident as to stake tens of million dollars on a guess, despite swimming completely against stream on the entire market's opinion about MGMRI? And it also makes me wonder if they were somehow involved, but that would be ridiculous, right? Stephen Paddock was a man of much wealth and enjoyed traveling, but it seems that he enjoyed going a bit further east than most. Stephen ended up finding himself on cruises to the Middle East. We aren't certain of the dates of these cruises, but we do know that he took at least 20 of them, some of which landed him in Jordan and the United Arab Emirates. An odd connection, sure, considering Stephen would allegedly go on to perpetrate the worst mass shooting in contemporary American history, that ISIS would then go on to claim, and the Saudi royal family was also possibly present in the midst of a civil war, but it's even more so strange since we have on solid evidence that the man was a covert op for the government, specifically engaged in the trafficking of arms, and here's where we're going to take things up to an 11. Stephen Paddock is known in the media as some rando dude who gambled and then got mad and shot up a festival. And I kid you not, some people try and argue that he slipped on the floor of a different casino and that made him so angry that he did this. And that is just lazy, despicable, awful media. And I know I don't want to belabor the point, we've discussed that a lot, but it's just too ignorant. But it's even more despicable because apparently the evidence has been right before our eyes. One bit of evidence that proves Stephen Paddock was a government agent in the most incriminating way possible, truly the only thing that could be more incriminating than this, would be if maybe a presidential assassin had a picture taken of him with the weapon in question after the event, had socialist papers in his hand, and the photo had apparently been heavily edited. That would be maybe more incriminating than this, which certainly that's not possible. And so on screen now, I'm going to show you a letter written from one client of Stephen Paddock's to a prospective client of Stephen Paddock's. And this letter is supposed to be a reference letter for Stephen so he can get a new contract of some kind. And so I'm just going to read it now and then give you my thoughts. Mr. Jim Nixon, America's Attorney Service, Inc., P.O. Box 80094, Balch Spring, Texas 75108. RE Accounting Service, Dear Mr. Nixon, please note that I have been working with Mr. Paddock for the past several years and believe that he will be the ideal accountant / investor for your business. Steve have a very unique accounting practice, and he is very professional, not to mention honest. 15 years with the CIA, he is funny and will keep you happy as long as you are his client. In other words, I have nothing but good to say about Steve. I realize you've only known Steve for about 3 to 5 years in a personal manner, but professionally, you will be impressed. Steve talks a lot about his CIA days, but he's a good person to know and will work for you. Please give him a chance. Sincerely, Mr. Albert Stockton. Firstly, How insane. This has just been sitting here and almost no one knows about this letter. And secondly, I think we can all understand that Stephen Paddock is probably not going to be doing much accounting or investing, and this letter is tongue-in-cheek. And it's pretty clearly, in my mind, referencing something else that Stephen is going to be accounting for and investing in, which I believe is further proven by the huge kahuna that this letter reveals to us. Right there, a close friend of Stephen Paddock and client references more than once that Stephen Paddock has been a CIA operative. Even crazier that he worked there for 15 plus years and often spoke about his experiences. Now this doesn't seem right at all. We have a mass shooter who in reality from what we know now is an arms dealer, which we could sort of tell already based on his previous work history and disappearance, but it's good to know because there was that inconvenient blank spot that left so much up in the air where he just had no work history for like 30 years, which now at least 15 years of has been filled up with his time at the CIA. And so we must wonder, is this why the media was so silent about Paddock while they didn't take advantage of the gun control narrative? Because the feds knew he was one of their own and were trying to hide it from us? And it was so obviously seen in a bunch of letters that the government already had, so then why were they only released 2 years ago? And why did I have to get linked to them on a random Reddit thread that then linked me to a random local news channel that only showed this letter for about 4 seconds in the overall context of letters telling Stephen not to shoot? Which I can't really tell if any of them actually even say that. So how is this possible? To my knowledge, I haven't seen it in any of the records I've sifted through. So what obscure government report or release did this get pulled from? I suppose at least now we have undeniable confirmation that Paddock is a Fed, but still, what the heck and how deep does this go? Typically, when you work for the government, you're a glorified wagee. But Stephen was anything but. In some way or another, his career in the weapons industry and CIA influenced him enough to rise to such a level that he became a multimillionaire many times over. And with his excess wealth, he acquired millions in real estate, but also two planes. And these two planes reveal far more than they should, or far more than the powers that be may want us to know. I found a good post that summarizes just about everything in relation to this, and so I'll read it, and then we'll back it up and prove it from there. Another question you might want to ask, if you looked at the website flightaware.com, and search a tail number, in this case N5343M, you will notice that the N number belongs to a SR-20 that at one time was registered to Stephen C. Paddock of Mesquite in Henderson, Nevada, our shooter. You will also see that it is currently registered to a company out of Roanoke, Virginia named Vallant LLC, a company that works with the Defense Intelligence Community per their website. Wait, it gets better. The registration is listed as active. Don't worry that it shows the last flight of the aircraft 3 years ago. They only show the flight when a flight plan is filed. FlightAware pulls their data directly from the FAA registration database, so it should be accurate, correct? Now that's the interesting part. If you go to FAA.gov and put the same tail number into their search engine, N5343M, you'll find that the FAA says the N number is inactive, and the last registration was a C-152, different aircraft, to some guy in San Diego, California, and no mention of the current registration by Vallant LLC or Mr. Paddock. The FAA database is updated every business day at midnight, so it looks like someone either scrubbed the FAA database and forgot, or didn't know that FlightAware posted the same info, or someone at FlightAware is playing a big trick on everyone and putting false information into their database. All I know is the name Stephen C. Paddock now has something in common with a spook outfit. Interesting. This sounds outlandish, but it isn't. The Paddock government connections do continue to get deeper, but something this post leaves out is that Vallant LLC and Vallant Associates, which is what it's referencing, are two different companies, technically. One might be tempted to combine them because Vallant LLC is, from what I can tell, a shell company, and Vallant Associates is a defense contractor with the same name. And the odds of these two companies sharing the same name, that being a French word, which is a military term, while being a few hour drive apart, or way less than that by plane, since we are discussing planes, is about nil in my mind. But let's scrutinize this claim a bit more and see if it holds up. First, let's view the registration address for this Vallant LLC. It pulls up a house in Virginia, just some random house, not an office. It does sometimes happen that you'll list your business address as your home address. It's not altogether common when seeking some sort of privacy, but it's possible. However, this house is particularly curious. You can't get very close via Google Earth or any other street view app I've found. The closest you can get is still pretty distant, and there are some conveniently planted trees that obstruct the view of anyone trying to peep the house from the back road. Nonetheless, we can see some curious things considering this home is connected to a war contractor, and therefore the government. That being two very similar looking black cars, at least two sizable outbuildings, in addition to a pretty big home with windows that we can't look into, and also what I believe to be a relatively large satellite sitting behind some trees in the backyard, that would be easy to miss. It's also a nice piece of property set a bit back off the road with few neighbors and line of sight, especially considering the trees. I find this all a little too strange to pass up, but it does get weirder. When looking up the address online, it reveals that it's not actually a home, my bad, but a French restaurant named Charles L. doing a little look-see-loo, Charles L. is not a restaurant, let alone a French one, but it's apparently the name of a doctor, and looking up said doctor, we get the following information. Mr. Charles L. CNA specializes in certified nurse anesthetist in Roanoke, Virginia, and has over 31 years of experience in the field of medicine. Just realize that sentence does not make sense. He graduated from his medical school with his medical degree in 1994. He is affiliated with numerous hospitals in Virginia and more, including Grandstand Regional Medical Center. Mr. Charles L. is licensed to practice by the State Board of Virginia. Mr. Charles L. also practices at Roanoke, Virginia. He is accepting new patients as medical office and is available for appointments, preventative care, medical care, as well as ongoing patient care. When reading that, I realized that there are a lot more errors than I had noticed the first time. But without giving out any personals, I just want to say that none of what was told is possible or really makes sense. Firstly, the phone number given is real, but it's not for a doctor living in Roanoke, but it's the name of a man in his late 70s who lives in North Carolina, which is a little under 200 miles away, and who is certainly not a doctor from what I can tell. And because I'm really creepy and I wanted to make sure this wasn't some connection I've missed, I know he's been in the same home in North Carolina since 2015, meaning over a decade, and yet this other Charles, who has the same phone number apparently, the doctor in Virginia, is supposedly still taking clients and you can call him right now. That phone number, though, obviously won't go to a doctor. Admittedly, this is all weird, but so is the fact that the exact same description for this doctor appears across most references to his name online. A major red flag suggesting we are possibly looking at a dummy identity, and Charles the doctor is Charles the fake. Or a massive interstate coincidence is at play, but I doubt that considering he is allegedly practicing out of a very clearly not up to medical code house, and the home is listed everywhere as his business address as well, and suggests that he's practicing from there. He's also not the sort of doctor who can work on patients from his house, for at least a dozen reasons, but most prominently because if he turns the knob a little bit too much, you go into a permanent night-night. But I digress. Getting back on track, taking his little blurb and researching it across the internet, we find at face value that the records are just scuffed. The doctor's name that has been appropriated appears on a registry for anesthesiologists, and it brings up a doctor with a matching name and identification number, but this one got his certification in 2006. And from the small blurb we get about the Charles who's registered to the address for the business that purchased the Impact's plane, he got his certification 12 years prior in 1994. A pretty big mistake to miss when building an identity online. Also a major tell was that they did not even name the school that this doctor originally graduated from. Most people brag about that stuff, especially doctors. I mean, they did spend 14 years getting this degree in a lot of cases, and at the very least, it gives them a lot of credibility. After all, I don't want my doctor graduating from the school of my neighbor's front lawn. But the issue with giving a school when creating a fake identity is that you open yourself up for the chance of someone cross-referencing you against yearbooks and enrollment lists, and very quickly proving that you're a liar. Hopefully I'm not yapping too much on this, but this is one of the most dead-to-rights bits of evidence in this whole case. Clearly, if the company that shares the same name as the defense contractor located not too far away is actually registered to a fake dude whose fake office is out of a house with black cars and large satellite and a bunch of outbuildings in a private area of a private neighborhood with a lot of trees, the chances of the two companies are one and the same is extremely high. Sorry, want to see if I can get that in one try. But that's not the only strange thing about this plane. If you were to look deeper, you'll notice that the only known flight for this N number, which is the plane's identification number, was in 2014, 3 years before the shooting. One might ask then, what is the purpose of purchasing a plane and then not flying it? And I have a similar thought about that. What's interesting, though, is that we don't have to look very far to find out. Once again, if we follow the references given to us in this post, which are surprisingly great for a comment on Blogspot, no less, if we continue under the notion that PAC is involved with the companies closely or directly tied to war contractors in the government, we're going to have a solid heading. For when we look up the plane's N number on the FAA database, something happens. For context, every flight is logged at an airport the moment it's registered. That information is then sent to an FAA database, who every day at midnight will update the log information. This is true and consistent with what the post said. I actually went and looked it up. And this is how we know that the only flight for this plane occurred in 2014. And we can see a visual example of this on the Flight Aware database, which collects its data from the main FAA database. However, the FAA database shows that there is something strange going on, because they report that the plane Stephen Paddock owned, and what is ostensibly owned by a doctor now, had its flight number deregistered. Yet that's impossible, because we know that the plane was flown in 2014, and afterward under the same call sign. And therefore, what I imagine occurred is of the FlightAware site managed to secure the data on the plane and log it on its own site probably shortly after midnight the day of the flight when the FAA pools all of its data together. And the FAA, knowing this plane was intended for covert purposes, likely went to scrub said data on its platform shortly after receiving it, but it was too late for the automatic update that happens on FlightAware's end. Or I imagine happens on their end, I should say. Leaving us with a pretty interesting trail. It's also worth noting that if you look up the end number today on the FAA website, you are met with this screen. Further, it does seem like this post is correct, and the FAA data doesn't even match the correct plane and plane model, which is a whole nother issue. I really wish I could say it ended there, but it doesn't. The whole host of people who own this plane between Paddock and quote-unquote Vallant LLC are weird. One of them can be tied all the way back to an obscure LLC that has connections to hired guns domestically and abroad, and the other has a similar rigmarole to the first we discussed. I do think, though, it's not worth to jump down that rabbit hole because it would only come out as repetitive. But it's important to note that evidently the plane just sat during this time.
While other networks lie to you about what's happening now, InfoWars tells you the truth about what's happening next. Visit InfoWars.com/show and share the link today.
The last 5 years, I've had all these scientists on promoting spike protein detoxes that have saved so many people and done all this. And finally, we're like, hey, we better do our own. Let's make the best. We take the two best-selling ones, combine the two with stuff that the government tried to ban so people would die. And yeah, we're selling stuff that really works. Tell us about Ultimate Life Force. It's a horse pill. I take it a few times a year as a detox. So good for cardiovascular. Just one of the ingredients in this alone is on record a game changer they tried to ban.
Right.
This is so important.
N-acetylcysteine, better known as NAC, was widely available pre-pandemic, but during the pandemic, during COVID, they took it off Amazon because it was too powerful. Too many people were getting well from it. They say, okay, this isn't a supplement. This is a drug. Now, we're not making that claim this is a supplement, but it is a supplement that is so powerful it could be used and compared to something like that.
And what is NAC?
N-acetylcysteine is the main precursor to your body's master antioxidant, glutathione, right? Glutathione is what your body uses to detoxify everything. But most importantly, your lungs. NAC reduces lung mucus and is incredibly powerful. This is rocket fuel. This is the gasoline. This is the fuel you need to make the glutathione. But more importantly, even than that almost, I was taking a look at Ultimate Life Force and I forget about these things. These things are something that they wanted to ban even more. The natokinase and the serapeptase, those are compounds that go in and break down blood clots and scar tissue and inorganic things in the body. That's for the spike protein. The cool thing is everybody, every human can get healthy. It just takes different specific steps to get healthy. And that's why becoming knowledgeable about...
Well, that's like breeds of cows. They're like, these cows can handle the heat. These cows can't. These cows can handle cold. They can't. These dogs can handle this. These can't. We're all dogs. We're all cows. We're all the same species, but there's certain things each group can't handle.
No, 100%. I agree with that. And it's so key. I mean, the reason why Methylene Blue has just been such an incredible hit to the audience and to the supporters, listeners, to us, everyone, is because, well, like, we really feel the effect, you know?
It's like the Garden of Eden. God made all these things to work together.
It's all there. The information's readily
available. No, it's absolutely incredible. These are great products. They fund the operation. And, folks, it's common sense. Go get them. TheAlexShowStore.com. Get the bovine colostrum, get the methyl drive, get the power plant, get the methylene blue, get it all.
What's cool about supplements, at least to me, is you're able to look at these different genetic groups, and then you can go, okay, they need help with this one thing, we got a compound for that.
All we did was go out with the top selling products of all the studies and just combine them together.
100%. And I mean, you look at this product, the NAC alone makes it worth buying, but you've got four or five other things in there directly targeted to addressing COVID and long COVID.
People say, well, I don't have COVID right now. The point is, it's good for you, period.
100%. We've all got scar tissue in us. We've all got issues. We've all got these inorganic compounds, these microplastics. When you look at something like Ultimate Life Force, it might be able to address some of those situations. You look at this, you look at the other products we're offering you, it's kind of hard to do an individual pitch for them because they're all so amazing. It's incredible. We make this stuff for you and for ourselves. Everyone at the InfoWars office is gobbling these supplements left and right. That's why I made these, is so I could take them.
And then you designed it to go with our Ultra Methylene Blue.
Absolutely. That's the key. Before any, like, man or woman, young and old, if you're on Methylene Blue, you got to take it.
Everybody loves the formulas, and I've noticed if I take both together, the energy is totally insane. Each one is very strong on its own.
Methyl drive is something that every person in the country should take. This is something so powerful they tried to ban it.
So the methylene blue is like the engine and gasoline These products together is the nitrous oxide.
Exactly. It turbocharges.
InfoWars tells you the truth about what's happening next. Visit InfoWars.com/show and support the InfoWars.
Evidently, the plane just sat during this time, according to official records, unused. And one of the people who owns it is a businessman placing foreign students in housing. Take that as you may. And from his records, I saw the annual revenue for his business is around $250,000, which, assuming that's accurate, is nothing to scoff at. But his take-home pay is probably not nearly sufficient to fund the acquisition of Paddock's plane, which price ranges from $250,000 to $750,000. A little steep for him based on our records, but also not sure how you could really count that as a business expense unless something else is going on. Once again, some basic facts that raise some important questions. I'm going to try and speed through this because this rabbit hole goes so deep. Stephen Paddock is tied to what some estimate to be at least 100 different registered businesses. And from what I can tell, these are shell companies. Interestingly, basically all these companies have since shifted ownership, many to the same handful of people, and seem to have skated by untouched by the legal system in the retribution process for the Vegas victims. The companies range just about as broadly as one can imagine. I've seen some that claim to be involved in media consulting and web development, and others that are in the water-moving business. The websites for these companies, if they even bother to make one, are comically bogus. The same can be said for many of the LinkedIn profiles allegedly behind them as well. It seems Paddock wasn't very creative, naming 25 different companies Paradise Ranch. Legit, Paradise Ranch 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. I don't know what this entails beyond the fact that having a good info, Paddock is at minimum a fed with CIA work history who sells arms. We should be plenty suspicious, and a bunch of shell companies is the sort of things you do in this business. You know, that being from my decades of experience in international arms dealing. And that's all pretty easy to believe stuff, considering the evidence we have is really supportive for that. But where I've seen people go off the deep end and where I think there's actually been some injection of fake news is if you look a little bit deeper. I don't personally believe this next part, but it's worth noting because of the following reasons. Paradise Ranch, which Paddock named so many of his companies after, is a nickname many officials and employees use for Area 51. And Area 51 is a less than 2-hour drive from his house, and based on his plane capabilities, around an hour flight. Additionally, there is a NASA scientist who published articles on a variety of topics, including rocket propulsion, and was involved in Operation Slingshot. And this scientist's name, you might have guessed it, is Stephen Paddock, but it's a different spelling across various articles. And this turns out to be a red herring, though, I truly believe, because it's, by all accounts, a different man. I've even seen a photo of the guy. Like I said, though, name differences, and he's way too old. And so I think this was intentionally added to really skirt you away from where we need to be focused. Now, that was all quite convoluted, and I hope it wasn't too confusing. And to some degree, I'm still trying to work out a lot of this myself and what it could really mean. But if it was confusing, then I do apologize, because we're going to have to go a layer deeper here. Paddock's girlfriend, baby mama, whatever you want to call her, is one of the most suspicious characters in this entire event, who's gotten very, very little attention. Criminally little attention, I might add. Mary Lou Danely was one of Paddock's many women over the years, including at least two wives, and yet seemingly little is known about her. From the start, one would anticipate she had been popping the charts for any investigation into the Vegas shooting, but she really wasn't. And the main excuse that has been given for why she was never really investigated very deeply is that she was in the Philippines at the time of the incident. Not altogether surprising, because Paddock frequently visited there with and without Mary Lou. But on the off chance we could cast some doubt on if she were actually abroad at the time of the shooting, we could then get some answers to some other loose ends that this case has presented, specifically those relating to the mysterious woman that Stephen had added to his reservation at the MGM Mandalay Bay. Three women, to be precise, all of whose names have been redacted, as well as allegedly a hooker, but I think more and more that that hooker connection might just be a red herring. It would also answer how Stephen Paddock was able to get a room comp to him with Mary Lou's points while she's on the other side of Earth, and apparently even using using her card and ID. I don't think you would typically be able to do that, nor would Steven, the man who was such a high roller. His brother says he got an entire floor of the Atlantic Casino in Reno, Nevada for his family to stay in. I doubt that that guy would also need his baby mama's few points to get what is a relatively inexpensive suite compared to where he was actually staying. Getting back on track, there's a substantial reason to believe that Mary Lou may have been in Vegas for the shooting despite official reports. The reason I suspect this to be a possibility is that at minimum two eyewitnesses report seeing Mary Lou, or at least someone who looks very much like her, in the days prior to the Vegas incident. These reports were taken by the police, but to the best of my knowledge, not really investigated. The first report reads as follows. I got a request to pick up Paddock at terminal number one pickup area for Uber. Not sure what day or time. I pick up a man and women with a big blue suitcase and looking and heard he commented on the Mandalay Bay area for a terrorist attack and dropped at the Mandalay Bay. P.S. Maybe check Uber's records. Now that is a little curious, and the next post reads as follows. At least two people told police they saw Mary Lou Danley or someone matching her description in the days prior to the shooting. A waitress at the noodle shop said she recognized Paddock and Danley from the news, but she paid more attention to Danley when she reported seeing the couple eating together on September 29th. I just joking around with the hostess and I tell her, I bet that lady's Filipina. She said, I don't focus on him too much. I was looking that lady. You know, women, we criticize each other sometime from far away. She looked so young, but when you get close, that why I recognize her in the picture because, she got, the root, the white hair. I would say this is what we refer to as a wrench, and it tosses nicely into the wheels of this entire investigation that the police conducted. It makes me think it should be a requirement for the feds to release all the evidence unredacted, because I don't think we can quite take their word on what happened in this incident. For instance, where's a copy of the boarding pass or an itinerary of any kind showing Mary Lou Danley actually went to the Philippines, or maybe some photos she took while she was there? I'd be so grateful to see it all. But there is something else, and I wonder if you noticed it. The eyewitness testimony states clearly that Paddock and what we presume may have been Mary Lou Danley were picked up from the airport and then taken to the Mandalay Bay, which is totally different from the story that Paddock drove to the Mandalay Bay from his home in Mesquite. And so we have a few possibilities. We've been lied to, and Paddock did not drive to the Mandalay Bay from his home. Or Paddock did drive to the resort, but for some reason Ubered back to the airport and then Ubered back to the resort. Or the other reason I can think of is that he went to pick someone up, but that wouldn't explain why he didn't just take his car. So it's all very strange. And in either instance, it requires us to ask, what was with Paddock? After all, it can't be denied someone arrived at the Mandalay Bay with him from the airport. A woman who, based on other descriptions, may have been the same woman who arguably knew the most about him, that being Mary Lou Danley. The woman who, in her own words, warned the police that her fingerprints might pop up on the bullets because she had helped load them into the magazines. Which is beyond ridiculous. One other possibility is that maybe she was in the Philippines and then came back early, or literally was just never there at all and came late. Especially considering now that there is solid evidence she may have been a full-throated fed. The FBI. The garage was empty, and the neighbors report seeing the two packing up their cars at various times as if they were moving, but when asked, they said they had no intentions of moving. They always had their blinds down, and they were all around weird people. Mary Lou was very kind, but Paddock was put offish. This is practically speaking the sentiment shared by all of the neighbors' testimonies I have encountered who knew Mary Lou Danley or Paddock to some regard prior to the incident. And this strangeness is just going to be emblematic for the story of Mary Lou, who, despite media reports, is not quite as normal as we might think. She's right about 70 now, and her history is nearly as murky as Paddock's, but we do know that she was born in the Philippines on December 12th of 1954. She then moved to Australia, already having a child when she arrived. We don't know if this was from another husband or out of wedlock. While in Australia, she married a man, either first or second husband, we don't know.
But soon we got tired of him and left in the late 1980s. So when she moved to Arkansas, which is quite a long way from Australia.
And while there, she married a man whose name I shall leave out because I feel really awful for him. And this was in the year 1990. She also brought her daughter with her as well to America, the daughter of the original man, presumably in the Philippines, who we don't know whether or not she was wed to. But getting back to Arkansas, the family, which included her husband's own daughters, moved to Memphis and then Nevada, and in 2013, while still married to this man, she started committing adultery for the second or third or maybe fourth time.
Bullet lodged in the base he was playing.
With who we now know as Stephen C. Paddock. But here's where it's going to get even more confusing. Reports from neighbors about Mary Lou prior to meeting Paddock state that she was a great wife and mom, as mentioned during this period. Yet somehow, while being a wife and mom in Nevada, Mary Lou is also a high-limit poker hostess at the Atlantis Casino in Reno, Nevada. I'm not even certain if she lived near that casino, and it's an over 7-hour drive from Paddock's home in Mesquite. So that's just odd. And this is allegedly where she would meet Stephen Paddock while being a hostess in the High Limit Poker Room. And we do know that Paddock did visit this casino, and we know that he once even got the entire floor comped for his family, which is just an insane thing to think about. And knowing Mary Lou hops from man to man like it's an Olympic sport, or like a frog on lily pads on a rainy day, that seems like the sort of thing that would attract her attention. But something just doesn't smell right about all this. Mary Lou has all these husbands and baby daddies and multiple citizenships and seemingly knew what Paddock was up to the night of the shooting. She kind of gives away the whole bag by privating and then deleting her Facebook account the night of the shooting prior to Stephen being announced as the culprit. So nah, something more is going on. And so I dug a little bit more and got this gem you're not going to find anymore. But if you were to search for Mary Lou around 2017 on a database for employers named Intellius, which is a background check of sorts, Mary Lou had a profile that the system had generated that seemingly gave accurate names and related addresses, but among these names, it did accurately include her previous husband before dating Paddock. In addition to that, the site also included this pesky detail that while working at the Atlantis Casino, she was allegedly involved in working for the FBI as well. What? That seems like a pretty big deal to me. Indeed, assume the data is correct, which for all intents and purposes, I can believe because the other data seems to be correct, then this would be a pretty hard fact to circumnavigate. And it would make her history a little bit more logical. It's not easy to become the citizen of three countries and maintain an extremely low profile. To the point, the only real information that's available about you online is scant to nil prior to Paddock allegedly popping off in that hotel room. And it does suggest, in my opinion, that Mary Lou may have known the shooting was going to occur and was perhaps there considering her identification card was used to comp the room, allegedly to Stephen. And her fingerprints being on the bullets, come on, bro. Something else is up here. And it also makes me a bit more confident in my summations because the sources for this information about the FBI connection have basically been scrubbed from the internet. And this Wayback Archive of it has 21 views as of writing, so hopefully we can get a couple more eyes on that thing. The next one we have gone pretty in-depth to in part two, but I think this article is worth including because it really just speaks for itself. Investigators probing whether others were in Las Vegas gunman's suite. Woo, shocker. Investigators are trying to nail down whether anyone else was in the hotel suite reserved by the Las Vegas gunman during the time he was registered there. Multiple senior law enforcement officials briefed on the investigation into the shooting told NBC News. The investigators are puzzled by two discoveries. First, a charge was found that does not match any of the cell phones that belonged to Stephen Paddock, the man who killed himself inside the Mandalay Resort and Casino after sending a barrage of bullets down on a crowd of 22,000 people below. I would also like to take a moment and interrupt this article to state that Stephen Paddock had 7 different cell phones in his hotel room. Definitely not the typical boomer. Continuing with the article though, it says that, and second, garage records show that a period when Paddock's car left the hotel garage, one of his key cards was used to get into his room. Hotel staff, in their own words, admit to visiting Paddock's room 10 separate times, including one instance where they brought a second fridge to his room. But, they didn't notice anything strange in their own words. And that little ditty about the fridge comes from the LVMPD's final report on the matter, which, considering the horrors of that night and the mystery surrounding it, 178 pages seems a little light for a final report, so come on guys, get your numbers up. In addition to that, Paddock actually called the hotel staff to his adjoining room, comped to his baby mama's name, and reported that there was a smell and it needed to be freshened up. The staff member reported later to the police that he had seen no luggage in the room, a far cry from what it would look like the night of the shooting. A fact that most don't know about Stephen Paddock is that he possessed 2 laptops in his room. One was hooked up to the camera system he had monitoring the inside and outside of his room, and the other seemed to be used for business affairs. Hotel staff report seeing Paddock working from one of them, but from what I can tell, they didn't see the other. The feds, upon entering Paddock's room that night, noticed that one of his laptops is sitting on the bed and the other is on the floor missing its hard drive. What most media outlets I've read, though, don't report is that it had also been disassembled, the entire computer, which suggests a pretty advanced understanding of computers and a relatively specific tool set. Keep this in mind for what I tell you next. On Paddock's other computer, the police claim to find a hard drive full of images of children. I won't go any further, just let that one sink in. In addition to this, on Paddock's browser, he just so happened to have over a dozen search queries for the police to look at conveniently, of which were seeking information about venues that overlooked event centers. Convenient, I say. As well as a search query for where the hard drive is in the Dell E5570 laptop. the computer Paddock was supposedly using. This whole story in mind, that should strike you as a pretty convenient narrative. You find the shooter who was advanced enough to disassemble his one computer and remove the hard drive, but is super confused on how to do it to another, which also appears to be the same computer. I don't know. Fat chance of that to me. Also, if you were, as the prevailing narrative goes, conducting the shooting because you were bored with life and knew you were most likely not going to make it out of this thing alive, then why would you go to the effort of removing your hard drive and disassembling your computer? You're likely going to be deceased anyway, so why would you care then? Moreover, if you did feel the need for some reason to destroy evidence, I would think the kitty pics would be the first to go. But since they weren't, I'm left to suspect that maybe the even more incriminating information was on the other computer in the other hard drive, in my mind perhaps linking the feds directly to him. I don't know. But it seems that, once again, whoever was in charge here was an absolute amateur hour, because they didn't even bother to do a good job covering this up. The feds tell us that there were two laptops that were found, one disassembled lying on the floor and one on the bed. The story then changes, and there's three laptops now. One on the bed, another plugged into the camera system and sitting on the room service cart, and a third in a random area of the room, in their words, now broken and in a bag with empty boxes of ammo. So there's three computers now, or two, but this third one isn't disassembled on the floor, it's broken in a bag. It might be easy to assume that this is mixed up with the one that's disassembled, but that's not the same thing at all. Disassembled is the intentional taking apart of an item. Broken is destruction. There's a difference, and I would expect the police to understand that difference when describing a crime scene. The report then seems to be refuting itself, because now I'm starting to think that there might be four computers, the two intact ones, the one disassembled one on the floor, and the other broken one in the bag. So what's going on then? Also, the computer that Paddock had searched how to remove the hard drive from is the computer the police allegedly found all these images and evidence on, from what I can tell. So Paddock knew how to remove the hard drive then from the computer and disassemble one of his computers off the dome and had the supplies to do it, but had to look up how to do it for the other one. Okay, fine, let's just say he had to look it up. Then why then, after doing said research, does he decide that, eh, I don't care, let them just find whatever they want on my laptop? Like, what? Huh? What? At this point, I don't think the police actually expected anyone to read what they wrote, because it's got more holes than Swiss cheese, which is likely why at no time does anyone explain where Steven's hard drive is then, if it's not in the computer or in the hotel room. The man disassembled the computer shortly before the shooting, or possibly right afterwards, we don't know. So then, are we to believe that the hard drive unscrewed itself from the computer and walked off? And if the evidence on there was so unimportant to the police that they didn't even ask where it went, then why did Eric Paddock, Steven's brother and real estate pal, tweak out when questioned by the police? Here are a few quotes from that quote-unquote interview. Eric was upset with Paddock until he learned Paddock had removed the hard drives of the computers found in the hotel room. Eric was upset because Paddock had completed the taxes for the family and had cheated on them. Eric was afraid the hard drives would implicate him and his mother for tax evasion. Upon learning the hard drives were missing, Eric said several times, maybe he, parentheses Paddock, did care for us. Gonna interject here. Why did you give away that he was evading taxes? They didn't have the proof. You just incriminated yourself. So I don't really think that's the reason, or at least not the main one. And another quote I picked out for you reads as follows. Eric felt Paddock cared deeply for Danley and would do whatever possible to help take care of her. Eric expressed anger over the possibility of Danley having access to his monetary assets. Eric referred to Danley as a gold digger. Like I said, I do wonder then if this was some simple creative accounting that was occurring on those computers that Eric was so mad about, or if he knew something else was going on them, and that was the real reason he was so fussy. After all, Eric Paddock, in his own words, was not quite the fan of the feds. Eric told investigators he and Paddock were smarter than the majority of other people. Eric told investigators he was in Las Vegas to help and show how dumb you mother
didn't push worship Satan
are, referring to law enforcement. Eric believed Paddock would have planned out every part of the attack methodically. Paddock would have a need for everything found in the room. Despite appearing unkempt and in poor health, Paddock was very detail oriented. This is one of those areas where I just wish I could be a fly on the wall or have an actual honest investigation or reporting, because this report should be thousands of pages of long and cover every single inch of the event and every word spoken in every interview, but we barely get any information and the interviews we are reading from are paraphrased, meaning who knows what was actually said, especially since this report from Eric Paddock and several other family members' interviews are only composites of multiple interviews, so the entire thing just stinks even more. But hey, at least we got sentient hard drives that disappear themselves when the feds get too close. Or it was purloined, whatever you choose to believe. Either way, a literal manhunt should have occurred to recover that hard drive and should still be occurring. The snorkel. I don't know what else to say about this except that Stephen Paddock, amongst his arsenal, also had what the police have called a snorkel. I think it's jerry-rigged, not manufactured, and it's another detail that makes less than zero sense in this case. Unless Stephen wanted to go snorkeling at a coral reef in downtown Las Vegas Strip in the middle of a desert, then some explaining needs to be done about that. We're on the home stretch now. What few appreciate or can appreciate about this case are how weird the actual photos of Paddock's body are. I happen to have several of them on my computer just for this. And they are in fact out there online if you were very, very curious. And the unblurred pictures of his head and body are specifically there. And for obvious reasons, I'm not going to show that here. So I thought the creative way to do this would be to draw what I'm referring to for you guys. But I don't want you to judge because I'm not an artist, okay? So if you were to pull up Paddock's body, there are a few things you may notice. One, throw his two separate blood stains coming from his noggin. The first looks hours old and is dried into the carpet for the most part, while there's another one that has seemingly formed recently, pulling out of him over top the other dried blood stain. This isn't possible to my knowledge unless something fishy is afoot, but fish don't have feet, which makes me even further suspicious. One may also notice that there is a blood stain on Stephen Paddock's chest. I can't find a top-down angle of it, but it does look like another GSW, which would require us to ask some more questions. After all, there's only one family that's allowed to have friends perish to multiple self-inflicted gunshot wounds without investigation. Paddock's foot is also seen resting under a gun that is gently set over his leg on its bipod. Pretty hard to move your leg under there after taking your life. Paddock is wearing gloves that just seems weird to me. Fingerprints shouldn't be a concern if the prevailing narrative were true that this is just a shooter and not a gun deal. And if it's for the heat, then these probably aren't the best gloves. But if you were an arms dealer and you were seeking to keep your prints off the evidence, then this would be a great way to do it. There's also a random third glove sitting on the counter, and I wonder if this is missing its friend and if it's with whoever else was in that room that evening and throughout Paddock's day in Las Vegas. Additionally, Paddock's lying on top of another firearm, which I just find to be so strange. The gun that allegedly allowed Stephen to transmit the bullet through his noggin, as we discussed last episode, is several feet behind him, and that doesn't make any sense. It's also got a trail of blood leading to Paddock, and what looks like a fingerprint on it, or someone had touched it in some way. Oh yeah, and Stephen Paddock was 6'3 and well over 200 pounds, and this body doesn't look remotely like that. And more interesting, what remains of Stephen's face and head don't, in my opinion, look much like Stephen. But what do I know? Okay, toodles!
Boom, we're done. There it is, the Vegas series. All in all, everything I think I wanted to say, there are some details. So if you guys are, I can't even offer that. There are other details, but I think that's all the major stuff that we hit. So I want to quickly say thank you so much for watching this video. If you made it this far, you're an absolute, I don't know how to call you. Legend just seems like an understatement. So for now, I guess we'll just say you're an absolute legend. Thank you so, so very much. It really does mean the world to me. Remember though, oh, how could I forget? If you don't hear from me and I disappeared into the woods, you find out, or somehow I slipped and fell or off a ledge or drowned or something like that, I just want it to be known that I can swim. There's no power cord in the home. I don't typically use a toaster in the bathtub. I'm not a big heights guy, so you're not going to find me on top of a skyscraper and just randomly slip on a rainy day. None of that. I just wanted to put that out there for no specific reason, but I, once again, like I said, really appreciate you guys for being here and for the support of the channel. I hope you guys are really enjoying this. And if you made it this far, you should hype the video. I don't know what it does, but it sounds kind of cool, so make sure to do that. And yeah, all in all, doing great, and I appreciate every single one of you guys. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to see each and every one of you in the next one.
Lie to you about what's happening now. InfoWars tells you the truth about what's happening next. Visit InfoWars.com/show and share the link today.
The new goal is to cause an individual to become subservient to an imposed control, to the point where he will perform acts against his will and then have no memory of the act. The search for a real-life Manchurian candidate begins. In the Hollywood classic directed by John Frankenheimer, a hypnotized soldier is programmed to assassinate a presidential candidate. Like a clip from the movie, the CIA attempts to create its own Manchurian assassins using hypnosis and drugs.
You create this new identity inside that's hidden from the main part of the person by an amnesia barrier. And then using an access code, you can call out this new identity for whatever mission purpose.
To produce such an assassin, the CIA faces two main challenges. how to induce amnesia, and how to program in new behavior. In 1957, Dr. Ewan Cameron, an eminent psychiatrist in Montreal, believes he has the answers.
The agency sought him out because they had noticed his work, in particular with two techniques, intensive electroshock and what he called psychic driving.
Cameron applies his techniques under the guise of normal therapy.
It's hard to say just how awful and horrendous what Cameron proposed and what our government financed was. It was a three-part technique which started with an effort to wipe out past patterns of behavior. And this was accomplished through the use of particularly intensive, repeated, high-level electroshocks until no more convulsions could be elicited from a patient.
Cameron then plays tape-recorded messages through helmets that are locked to his patient.
While other networks lie to you about what's happening now, InfoWars tells you the truth about what's happening next. InfoWars.com/show.
We'll join our regularly scheduled program after these messages.
I saw this a few weeks ago. We got it done. That young girl that is the return of the British queen that fought the Romans, Boudica. Look at this. The West awakens. Look at this badass shirt, ladies and gentlemen. It's got a red InfoWars over the heart on the left, and then it's got her on the back. I designed this shirt. I think it's amazing. The West Awakens 2025. This is a badass shirt, and it literally funds people totally committed to freedom. Then we've got Virtue Signal, and it's the Cracker Barrel symbol right there that we updated there. So we got that. We've also got another, the West Awakens with the hatchet and the butcher knife, ladies and gentlemen. Get them now at theyellowshowstore.com. But what you really want is the ultramethylene blue, the Shilajit, the Irish sea moss, all of it massively discounted, 25% off across the store, apparel, all of it. We've got buy one bottle already discounted, the Shilajit or the Atomic Defense Immune Boost, and get another bottle half off. The point is, we got War Bonds. That's a nice little piece of art you get with my face on it. You get $110 for $100, and it's mailed to you as a promo code on it for the site. But everybody that becomes a VIP, $30 a month, just like being Amazon Prime, you get $40 to spend each month right when you pay that. You cancel any time, get a special deal, special offer, special sales. I need your support. Wars aren't cheap. So what do good salesmen do? They sell good products. You are insane if you don't get our methylene blue. You are crazy if you don't get our Ultimate Life Force Blood Detox. It's all there at TheAlexJonesStore.com. Take action now and get these new limited edition shirts like the F Around Find Out.
Now, back to our program.